I think, as some of you know, that I have been having some conversations with a doctrinal committee in United, and it has to do with the Resurrections booklet that many of you have. And some interesting things are coming up, and they're still interested in looking at it at least, which is, I think, a milestone in itself. You never know what kind of response differences of opinion will get, and today I'm going to present to you something that contains a certain amount of a difference of opinion, but I think it's one that will help us clarify an important section of Scripture. The Church has traditionally held for a number of years, has admitted at least, and I've had many ministers admit to me that they don't have this particular answer, but we have always wondered exactly how and when do those people who are converted during the millennium, how are they enjoined into the family of God? When are they made spirit, and when are they brought into the family? And we don't really have a good, clear answer in that, at least not in our traditional explanations. But I want to pose to you something today, and it's a little different in a couple of respects, and I'll point those out to you. And you can disagree if you feel you need to, but at least I want you to look into it, to search the Scriptures on these matters and find out, because I think we do have a priceless explanation of that question. It's just that we haven't noticed it in the past. So though the message today may rock the boat a little bit, I think it's important that we do it because there is some information here in front of us that once we understand what it's talking about, I think it's very clear. We'll see what you think. They say a rising tide lifts all boats, which is a truism. And to that I might add, a ripple in the pond bounces everybody's rubber ducky. So I'm going to make a little ripple in the pond and evaluate it yourself. But our focus today is the 14th chapter of the book of Revelation. Most people have a lot of difficulty explaining the book of Revelation. And as an entirety, it is very complex. But this one chapter, I don't think, is all that complicated. It's one of those chapters we call an inset chapter. What an inset chapter is, basically, is you're going along, you've got this narrative explaining what's going to happen, and then what's going to happen next, and then what's going to happen after that. You've got this progression that you're going through. But every once in a while, the writer stops and expounds upon a particular subject within that. There are many insets. There's one place where it talks about the church. And there's another inset that talks about the fall of Babylon. And this chapter also, I see, as an inset. It stops in the narrative. Now, within itself, it's entire, but it breaks away from the running narrative in the book, and it explains a particular aspect. The question is, what is that that it's explaining? What is Revelation chapter 14 explaining to us? And that's the question, and that's what I want to present to you today. What I'm going to say is going to call upon your understanding to a degree of the resurrections and how they work. I've spoken on the subject before. Right after the feast, I did a message on the resurrections. But that's not so much the subject today, but it is implicit in what we're going to be looking at. But Revelation 14 is rather interesting. In a Nelson King James Bible that I have, it subtitles verses 14 to 16 of this chapter is the reaping the earth's harvest. And I think in that we have a clue as to what this subject is within this inset chapter. And above verses 17 to 20 it has reaping the grapes of wrath. So we have two distinct segments there. Now, an old Oxford King James that I have subtitles this section, the latter half of the chapter, as the harvest of the world. both of them at least, indicating a general awareness of what is being presented. What is the subject of this inset chapter? And I pose to you that it is the harvest of the world. And with that thought in mind, we can begin to understand, I think, the context or what this chapter is presenting to us. And it answers an important question. Chapter 14 is broken up into basically four distinct scenes, if you'll notice that. In verses 1 through 5, it talks about the 144,000. And in verse 4, it calls these 144,000 the first fruits. Now, we know who the first fruits are. And you can compare that with chapter 7, and you'll see more about them. But the 144,000 are the first fruits. They are they who are in the first resurrection. And they're standing with Christ on Mount Zion. That's how the chapter begins. Then it moves on to a second scene. Scene 2 is what we could call the angelic messengers, the messages. And there are three angelic messengers who come out, and they present three distinct separate messages. And that takes us from verse 6 to 13. And then we move to a third scene. And this is the curious one. The third scene is what is called the white cloud harvest. And that's verses 14, 15, and 16. In the white cloud harvest, one like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown and in his hand a sharp sickle, he harvests the earth, or at least a segment of this group of people. Who are these people? And then we move on to a fourth scene, and that's verses 17 through the end of the chapter, which we could call the winepress of God's wrath. So we've got four distinct scenes, but do we see in that a common element? I pose to you that there is a common element. The common element is this gives us the entire spectrum of God's harvest of humanity for his kingdom and what happens to those who aren't to be in his kingdom. That's the general outline of this chapter. We'll go through it in a little more detail, but I wanted to lay that out for you first. One of the problems that we have with this is many people, and commentaries have done it, and the WCG did it back years ago. If you have any of the old correspondence courses, you'll see that reference made. And frankly, I thought the same myself for many years. But that verse 20 is the problem. Many people have identified this winepress, trodden without the city, as being a reference to the Battle of Armageddon. Now, there is a problem with that, and I'll come to that shortly, but this is one of the assumptions, I guess we could say, that has been made that has caused us, I think, to miss some of the point of this chapter. There is a description of what the Battle of Armageddon is going to be like, and it's not like this. But because of some similarity of language in Joel chapter 3, people have made that cross-reference between these two passages. And that is one of the items that is this so-called ripple in the pond that I'm talking about. I pose to you that that particular scene is something different, and we'll come to that as we go through it. But we have these four distinct presentations. We have the 144,000. Then we have the messages to that segment of humanity who survives the Great Tribulation and the fall of Babylon. And then we have the harvest scene involving one group reaped by one like the Son of Man, followed shortly thereafter by a second group assigned to wrath, reaped by two collaborating angels. So that is the gist of Revelation chapter 14. It's telling us how and when God is going to reap the harvest of the earth. And you'll notice in verse 15, it says, the harvest of the earth is ripe. And then down in verse 18, it says, her grapes are fully ripe. Now, what happens when a harvest is ripe? Do you wait longer? If it's the time when they are fully ripe, we would presume that there is no further ripening process. If that's the case, then we have a time indication that we are up to the end of human experience when there isn't going to be any more ripening. This is it. And this is the time when it's appropriate to reap. And the particularly interesting thing is the fact that the reaping at the end, in the latter end of this chapter, talks about two separate groups being reaped together in time, but not together in their destination. And that is what provides us, I think, the answer to that question. When are those who are converted during the millennial age and the post-millennial age, when are they brought into the family of God? And I think we see that in verses 14 to 16. But let's go through this chapter, verse by verse, and I want to make some comments as we go along through it. Starting in verse 1, and I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. Now we know when that's going to be. We have a time reference in the wording there. That is when Christ returns. This is the time of the second coming. And that is when the first harvest takes place. This is what we could call the Pentecost harvest. Now, exactly who are the 144,000? Many people have different answers to that. One thing is obvious. These are the first fruits unto God. He says that plainly. Now, whether there are others with them, we don't know, but there's a particular focus on these, on this group of people, the 144,000, which very likely are key elements in God's established kingdom. In verse 2, and I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters and as the voice of a great thunder, and I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. This is some kind of an inauguration ceremony. There is a great chorus from heaven. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000, which were redeemed from the earth. That's telling us the first harvest, the early harvest, has already taken place. This is the first resurrection. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. So this is a high echelon in the beginning government of God. That's the first scene. And then right after that, something else happens. Starting in verse 6, and I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth. There's going to be survivors to every nation and kindred and tongue and people. And what is that angel going to say to them? Saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made the heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. Fear God, give glory to him, and worship the Creator That's the message of this first angel. And it's a message to the survivors of the Great Tribulation. And in verse 8, there followed another angel. Here's the second one, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. There's another time marker there. The second fall of Babylon. We know when that is. We have two whole chapters devoted to that, chapters 18 and 19. The fall of Babylon, the old Babylonian world system, and particularly its religious aspect, is going to be ended. Babylon is going to fall. And then a third angel comes out. And here's the one that's interesting. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture under the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Do you remember that passage, I think it's in Matthew, where Christ says, bring them who would not that I should rule over them and slay them here before me. This is referring to that time. But the wording of verse 10 is interesting because it tells what is going to happen to anyone who preserves the old religious system that they learned in whatever lifetime they lived. Babylon's been around for longer than just the end time. The Babylonian system has been in place long before even the New Testament era. But if anyone worships according to that system, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God. And notice how the language in verse 10 is very similar to the language in verse 20. And here's a technical point, if you can follow where I'm going with this. If we assign verse 20 to the Battle of Armageddon, then we have to say that the penalty is imposed on those people, because we know when the Battle of Armageddon is. The penalty is imposed on those people before the warning is given. Now, the warning is given after Christ returns, after the kingdom is set up, and when these three angels come out and give their messages. That is the message to the people still living at the onset of the millennial kingdom. So if we're going to identify verse 20 with the Battle of Armageddon, we're saying that the penalty is imposed on those people before they get the warning. That tells me that perhaps our assignment of verse 20 to that particular event is misplaced. But that's describing something else, and we'll come to that as we go further down through this. But just something to notice. Notice it talks about the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. That sounds like the crushing of the grapes that we see described down in verse 20. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels. So you see this dual component here of the winepress of wrath and being tormented with fire. Keep that in mind because that will be important as we get down past verse 17. And describing more of their punishment, and the smoke of their torments ascends up forever and ever, and they will have no rest day or night, who worship the beast and his image, and who worship, and whosoever receives the mark of his name. So that is the message to the survivors of the Great Tribulation, those people who live on into the millennial age physically, and their descendants. And then verse 12, it changes a little bit in the fact that he addresses this now to those people who are becoming converted in the millennial age. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. So there are people during the millennial age who are going to become converted. And then there's this interesting verse right here, verse 13. Because this tells us something about what will happen to the people who live and who become converted in the millennium. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yes, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. Now, the verse by itself is logical, and it's consistent with what we understand about Christianity, but it's the placement of it that raises a question. Where this is placed is a very exquisite moment in the narrative. He's talking to people who have the opportunity to become converted during the millennial age. And here he says, blessed are they who die in the Lord from henceforth. Now keep in mind, all of those who were in the Lord were raised in the first resurrection. So there wouldn't be any more, unless he's talking to people prior to the first resurrection. But if we regard this narrative as sequential, which it is, then he's saying to those people who are converted during the millennium, you are going to live out your lives just as people do in this present age. You're going to come to the end of your lives and you're going to go to your graves and await a reward. And there'll be more in the narrative here that demonstrates that. But I just want to bring that thought to mind. Blessed are they which die in the Lord from henceforth. This is telling us that people who live during the millennial age are not going to live for 1,000 years. They're going to have normal lifespans, just like we do today. They're going to become converted. They're going to live out their lives. They're going to come to the end of their lives, and they're going to go to their graves and await a sentencing. And that's what we see in the very next verse. Scene 3, the white cloud harvest, verses 14 through 16. There's a time break between verses 13 and 14. 13 is the message that is sent to them at the beginning of the millennium, but verse 14 is the scene at the end of the millennium. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. Now notice, this is talking about harvests. It's talking about the earth being ripe. It's talking about reaping, verse 15. If this were a battle, why would you go to battle with a harvest instrument? Wouldn't you use a sword or a spear or a bow or something else? If God wanted us to get the picture that this is a great battle scene, why would he so consistently refer to a harvest instrument? This is a picture of Jesus Christ. And he's reaping this first group that comes in this latter time. Verse 15, and another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time has come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in a sickle, and the earth sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. These, in verses 14 to 16, are the righteous. And commentaries make note of that. The Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown calls these the righteous. Even though they make the same assignment of verse 20 to the Battle of Armageddon, they at least see this much, that these, in scene 3, verses 14 to 16, are the righteous. What would the righteous be doing at the Battle of Armageddon? How does that factor into any of it? The point is, when we assign verse 20 to the battle against the Antichrist armies and the environments of Jerusalem, we miss the point of what this is really telling us. That isn't this scene. But at least the commentaries recognize that these are the righteous. Haley's Bible Handbook presents a similar assessment, that these in verses 14 to 16 are the righteous. But they make a further point that these are referred to as the harvest, while those in the next group are referred to as the vintage. The harvest are reaped for God's family. The vintage are crushed and burned up. Let's go back to the narrative in verses 17 through the end of the chapter. Another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven. He also had a sharp sickle, and another angel came out from the altar which had the power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in your sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. A couple of things to notice here. There's two parts to this reaping. One is for the purpose of pressing out the blood, and second is for burning up with fire. You have the angel with the sharp sickle who's going to reap, and that reaping, as we see in verse 19, is going to be cast into the winepress of the wrath of God. And then we have the angel with the power over fire who is going to deal out or mete out to them the second part of this harvesting, if we can call it that. Another angel came out from the altar which had the power over fire and cried with a loud cry to him that has the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horse bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. You know how long that is? This is 5 feet deep, roughly, chest deep, and 1,600 furlongs. That's 200 miles. Megiddo is only 50 miles from Jerusalem. This is an extraordinary event. This is no ordinary battle. This is no ordinary scene at all. And what I pose to you that it is all of the wicked of all time are going to be brought to this place for final sentencing. Verse 20 tells us what's going to happen ultimately to the wicked. It has nothing to do with the Battle of Armageddon. And once we make that break, once we separate our thinking from that, and I will admit that I used to think that myself until this round of conversations took place. When we do that to verse 20, we frustrate the message that's in this chapter. This chapter deals with all of the harvests of all of humanity of all time. We have the first resurrection illustrated by these 144,000. Then we have the final harvest at the very end. And that final harvest is a sheep from the goats type scene where we see one group separated from another. Now, Christ said there would be such an event. But the way that it has traditionally been described, we really don't have such an event in our explanations. And the world certainly doesn't. But there will be a separation of that sort. Let's look at a few examples of that. Let's go to Matthew 13. And Christ was consistent and he was frequent in mentioning these kinds of things. But Matthew 13, he referred to it repeatedly. He said, this is the way it's going to be. Verse 41, Matthew 13, 41. And this is the tares from the wheat parable. Verse 40, as therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so shall it be in the end of this world. This is the very end. This isn't talking about the first resurrection at all at this point. This is the end of this world. The real end. The end that's out beyond the millennium. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity, and shall cast them into the furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who has ears to hear, let him hear. We see a situation where the two are brought together, brought up together, and the discerning angels separate one from another. Move over to chapter 40, verse 49 of the same chapter. Starting in verse 47, again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a net that was cast into the sea and gathered of every kind, which when it was full, they drew it to shore and sat down and gathered the good into the vessels, but cast the bad away. They're all netted. They're all brought in together. And someone goes through the catch and separates the good from the bad. That's the picture you get. And then, of course, you've got Matthew 25. Matthew 25. Starting in verse 31. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. And before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. Again, we have the picture of a great group brought in together, and then they're separated out one from another. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. You can't set one on the right hand and the other on the left if they're not in proximity to one another. You can't bring these sheep and these goats up in different eras and still say one on the left and one on the right. Obviously, they're being brought up together and separated, just like we see in Revelation chapter 14, where the righteous are singled out first, they're reaped by Christ, and then the residue, the remainder, the wicked, are reaped by angels. Now, what's the picture of this blood to the horse bridles? What is that talking about? We know in places like Hebrews 9:22 that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. Now, people's sins can be dealt with one way or another. We can either accept the substitutionary sacrifice of Christ's blood, and if not, then the penalty will be paid with the individual's own blood. And that's the scene we see in verse 20. Nothing could illustrate that more graphically. The wicked are going to pay the penalty for their own sins in the winepress of the wrath of God. That's how it works. That's what that's talking about. That's how it could be such a massive amount. To have a flow that extends out 200 miles, starting about 5 feet deep, it would take an incalculable number of individuals for that to be produced. But that's the picture that God gives to us. And when we understand that chapter 14 of Revelation is referring to the harvest of the world at the very end, then we can pick up the sense of what this is talking about. But it gives us the answer, you see. When are those who were converted during the millennium and the post-millennial age, when are they added to the family of God as spirit beings? We have that answer. It's at the very end. It's at the sentencing that comes at the end of time. The white cloud judgment. And that judgment is to sentencing. We have another term with a similar, we call it the white throne judgment, that we understand to be the period of time of the second resurrection era, when people are afforded their first opportunity for salvation. But this is the final end of that evaluation process. This is the final end of that judgment. Now, we know that judgment has come upon the house of God. We have verses that tell us that. And we understand that to be evaluation, not sentencing. And so it is with these people.